Welcome to the Connor's Corner segment of Ask the Lawyer. Our next guest is author Steve Snyder. He has a book out about his father. The name of the book is Shot Down, The True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the Crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing great, Mike. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on your show.
Okay, so what is the story? Your father was a pilot in World War II. What happened to him?
Correct. He was a B-17 bomber pilot during World War II. He was with the 306th Bomb Group stationed at Thurlow, England. He arrived there in October of 43. And on February 8th of 1944, his plane was shot down. It was a mission to Frankfurt, Germany, where they dropped their bomb successfully. But their bomb bay doors got hit by anti-aircraft fire, flak, it was called. And they couldn't get the doors back up. And as a result, that caused a drag on the plane. They lost airspeed and they started lagging behind the bomber formation, heading back to England to their bases. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf fighters who came in for the kill. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth, which was named after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that my dad went overseas, it was shot down. B-17 had a 10-man crew. Two of the crew were killed in the plane. The other eight bailed out, and the book goes into detail about what happened to each member of the crew and about all the Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them.
Let's just go back a second. How were the planes named back then?
Well, my dad was the pilot, and as such, he was the commander of the crew and the plane. So the pilot always had the last say on what the plane would be named, but usually he would talk it over with his crew to get agreement. Of the 10 men in my dad's crew, only three were married, and my dad was the only one that had a child. So my dad was older, too. Most of the crewmen on the B-17 bomber, the gunners were usually in their teens, 18, 19. The officers, there were four officers on a B-17. They were typically in their early 20s. My dad was an old guy, though. He was 28, so they would call him Grandpa, the old man. So I guess they had a little more respect for him as well. So that's how the names the planes were named and painted. It's interesting that the Air Force is the only entity that allowed their planes to be named and painted. The Navy didn't, the Marines didn't, nor that other countries, but the Air Force thought that it would help the morale of these young guys if they could personalize their planes and name and paint them.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I learned something already. Now, this is February 1944, so D-Day hasn't happened yet. It won't happen for a few more months. So there are not a lot of Allied troops in Europe then. So what happens? They get shot down.
Yeah, Belgium, as well as all of Western Europe, was occupied by the Nazis at that time. So there weren't any Allied forces, military forces on the ground, which was very tough on those countries. Typically, when airmen bailed out, and they were picked up by the underground. They tried to get the airmen back to England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. And quite a few airmen that were shot down were able to get out that way. The most famous escape route was called the Comet Line. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out. And they were either compromised by German infiltrators or various reasons. And my dad, he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture that whole time. He was hidden by a number of Belgian people during that time. He was moved from place to place to place. He might spend one night at one house or 6 weeks at another house. It all depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. And the people who hid my dad, or any downed airman for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but the lives of their friends and family by aiding downed airmen, because the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out They would be arrested, tortured, and either sent to a concentration camp or shot. And some of the people who helped my dad and his crew did meet that fate.
All right. So your father's missing in action as far as the official records go for 7 months, and he was going place to place. Was it town to town or?
Yeah, he went to various towns. It was right. They were shot down right at the French-Belgium border. In fact, my dad and the plane, they came down in Belgium, but the other guys that were able to bail out on his crew came down in France. So it was right at the border. My dad came down in the little village of Mackenwaz, Belgium, which is in and around Momigny-Chimay. He was in Charleroi for a while, but it was all southern Belgium.
All right, so he's on the run. What's happening?
Well, he was almost discovered several times by the Gestapo, and there's those instances are described in the book. And finally, my dad got tired of hiding. It was also awful stressful for him. After all, his plane was attacked by German fighters. It's on fire. He has to bail out, comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew. I can't communicate with the U.S. military, and he's being helped by complete strangers, and they couldn't communicate at the beginning because he couldn't speak French. They can't speak English, but he had a little French-English dictionary he could refer to, and any one of these people could be a Belgium collaborator and turn him over to the Gestapo. So finally, he got tired of hiding. Like you mentioned, D-Day occurred on June 6th of 44. Word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy, and he wanted to get back and into the fight. And unlike most airmen, before he went into the Air Force, he was in the Army up in the state of Washington for a year in the infantry, so he knew how to fight on the ground. And he wanted to get back in the fight, so he decided to join up with the French resistance called the Mackie. The people who were hiding him at the time strongly tried to talk him out of that because it was just so dangerous. He could die, you know, in the fighting against the Germans. And if the Germans had captured him, he would have been shot on the spot as a terrorist. But he felt it was his duty to get back in and do his job and fight against the Germans. So he fought with the French resistance. They harassed the Germans. They would sabotage railroad lines, disrupt communications, assassinate German officers, attack German convoys. And there's a number of instances that the group had encounters with the Germans. His group was made up of about 20 guys led by a French lieutenant who had escaped from a German prisoner of war camp. So there's not many guys that would have the bravery and the courage to do that. I doubt if I would, because he could have just stayed in hiding and, you know, hunkered down until the U.S. armies came up through France after D-Day and liberated the area. But he risked his life to fight against the Germans.
So eventually what happens? He's fighting with resistance. What's the next thing that goes on?
Then on September 2nd, word filtered through to the group that there were U.S. troops in a little nearby village of Trelon, France, which just crossed the Belgian border. So he walked into town, into the town square, went up to an army major, actually was an element of Patton's Third Army, which had come up through France after D-Day, and identified himself. They interrogated him to make sure that he was who he said he was. And then he hitched a ride on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris. And then from Paris, he hopped on a transport, C-47, and made it back to England, where he sent a letter to my telegram, Western Union telegram to my mother, saying he was fit as a fiddle and to bank the money, honey. He had all that back pay from being missing in action. And that was really tough on my mom, because not only did she have Susan Ruth, who was 1 year old, but my other sister was born when my dad was missing in action. So she was back home with two little baby girls, not knowing if she'd ever see her husband again. So that was really tough on her.
I can't even imagine that. Now, there were other members of the crew. What happened to them?
Well, five of the 10-man crew made it home. Five of them did not. I mentioned two were killed in the plane when it was attacked by the German fighters. The other eight bailed out. Three of them, they were picked up immediately by the Germans and became prisoners of war. Two of them were eventually repatriated back to the U.S. before the war ended because they had such serious wounds and injuries. That was Joe Musial and Richard Daniels. And then Roy Hulbert, the flight engineer, he spent the entire remainder of the war as a POW. And then there was another, the tail gunner, Bill Schlenker. He also evaded capture. He wasn't with my dad at all. In fact, after my dad bailed out, he had no idea what happened to any of the other members of the crew until he got back to England. But Bill Schlenker, he also evaded capture. And unlike my dad, he was hidden by one woman and her two daughters the entire 7 months. He never moved at all. And then there was three other members of the crew, George Ike, Robert Benninger, and John Pindrock, who was evaded capture for a little while. And they hooked up with five U.S. airmen from three other B-17s that had been shot down. There was eight of them hiding in the woods near Chimay, Belgium, in a little hut that some underground members helped them build. And they were waiting to get out, you know, through these various escape routes. They were waiting and waiting, but before they could get out, a Belgium collaborator told the Germans about them hiding there. And on April 22nd of 1944, about 1,500 German police, Gestapo, members of the military surrounded their hut, arrested them, took him into town to a schoolhouse, interrogated it, and took eight men back out in the woods, and they shot all eight of them.
Uh-huh. What was their legal grounds on that? Were they were in civilian uniforms? What was the...
Yeah, they were in civilian uniforms. A couple of guys still had some of their air gear on, but they did find a couple of guns in this hut, and they deemed them terrorists, and even though it was against the Geneva Convention, shooting them, they murdered all eight men, and also two young Belgium men who were in their early 20s and who were helping them were arrested as well, and they were sent to concentration camps and never heard from again.
How did you find out about this? What were the sources?
Oh, I am so fortunate, so blessed to know so much about my dad and his crew, because I go all over the United States attending air shows, signing copies of my book, and going and making PowerPoint presentations to all sorts of groups. And I constantly hear and I'm told by people that they know so little about their World War II veteran because they never talked about it.
Right.
And my dad didn't talk about it much until 1989 when a memorial was erected in Mackenwals, Belgium to my dad and his crew, and he and the three other crew members that were still living at the time went over for the dedication of the memorial. And there he was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him, revisited these places where he was hidden, and that brought it all back, and he started talking about it. And then 5 years later, in 1994, my wife and I accompanied my parents to Belgium for the 50th anniversary of the Belgium liberation of my dad's plane being shot down. And that's when it became personal for me, because I saw these things firsthand. So the story of my is all based on firsthand testimony by people who were involved in the events that took place, either members of my dad's crew who made it through the war. I probably wouldn't have written the book, though, if it wasn't for two Belgium gentlemen, Dr. Paul Delahaye and Jacques Lalot, who were young boys during the war, and they were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand atrocities committed by the Nazis against their friends and family. And later in life, they became local historians. They interviewed all these Belgian people and were members of the Belgium Underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew. And they documented their testimony, and they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that took place that have been lost forever without their research. So I, though, owe them a huge debt. And that not only did they give me all this information, but they sent me all these pictures taken by Belgian people. Also, some of my dad's helpers had sent him pictures that they had taken. There's over 200 time period photographs in the book, so you can visualize everything you're reading about. So I was just so fortunate to have all this detailed documented information. And then one of the most exciting things that happened during all my research was finding the German Luftwaffe pilot that shot down my dad's plane and interviewing him for the book. And he gave me some wonderful information about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force during the war. That's in the book.
So how did you find him out? That was one of my main questions in my mind. How did you find out this Luftwaffe pilot?
Well, that's a good story, too. You know, all my dad knew and all the U.S. military knew is that the plane was shot down by two German fighters, and that's all I thought I'd ever know. But one day when I was doing my research, my wife said, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot him down? Which I thought was a ridiculous idea. You know, she doesn't know what she's talking about. It'd be impossible. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. And lo and behold, I found him. His name is Hans Berger, and he's the only person involved in the shot down story that's still living. Hans is 96 years old. He lives in Munich, Germany. I've been over there a couple times, and we've become friends. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war, so he speaks perfect English.
What did he tell you? I mean, this is, you know, unbelievable.
Yeah, well, he was surprised when I contacted him. And I just started, for the book, I just interviewed him over the telephone and through email. But as I mentioned, in 2016 and 2019, I went and visited him in person. And I just started bombarding him with questions. One day he said, Steve, you know, you're asking me all these personal questions, and I really don't even know you. But I built up his trust, and as I said, we became good friends. He said it was unfortunate they had to be shooting at each other, but that was war. He was pretty much just like the U.S. airman. He was a young guy, 20 years old, you know, fighting for his country, trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. He was shot down 3 times, but he made it through the war. And in fact, the gunners on my dad's plane shot Hans down at the same time he shot my dad's plane down. So they shot each other down.
Now, how did he recognize the plane? How did he remember the name?
Well, he didn't recognize the plane or the name. You know, all he knew that over southern Belgium there, that on February 8th, and he pulled out his little logbook, flight logbook, and showed me his entry in the book on February 8th, where he shot down a B-17, and he was shot down and had to bail out. So, you know, he just remembered that it was a B-17 that he attacked and shot down. And after he parachuted out, he could see some of the guys on my dad's planes coming down in their parachutes as well. So he didn't know who he shot down, but he remembered that day quite well. Again, Belgium was occupied by the Germans there, so a German patrol picked him up and then put him on a train and sent him back to his air base to continue fighting in the war.
Now, the guys who were captured and ended up in POW camps, how were they treated?
There's a big difference between being a POW in Japan and then in Germany. The Japanese were ruthless. The Germans weren't. They abided by the Geneva Convention. That's not to say that there weren't U.S. airmen that were roughed up or as prisoners of war. But the main problem and issue that the U.S. POWs in Germany faced was the lack of food and the cold. Those winters, you know, especially in 43 and 44, were some of the worst. So the conditions, they were always freezing and you know, on the verge of starvation because they hardly got any food. That was their biggest problems.
Now, where was your father at the end of the war, VE Day?
Well, after he got back to his base, they sent him back to the U.S. And became a B-17 flight instructor. The Air Force had a rule at the time that if you were shot down over occupied territory and aided by the resistance, that you could not go back and combat again, because they thought if you were shot down a second time and captured by the Germans and tortured, that you'd give up the or they'd give up the identity of the people that helped them the first time they were shot down. The only exception to that rule that I'm aware of, and I've done quite a bit of research on this, is Chuck Yeager, who was a fighter pilot and personally met with General Eisenhower and talked him into letting him go back into combat. So my dad was then sent back home, and he was a flight instructor until the war ended.
Now, did he ever reunite with some of the people in Belgium that helped him?
Yes, the people he stayed lengthy periods of time with, he stayed in contact with after the war. They corresponded, and as I mentioned earlier, they'd sent him pictures that they had taken, exchanged Christmas cards, and then in subsequent years, you know, he did go back over and meet them and saw him again a few times. I was fortunate in 94 when I went over to meet one of his helpers because the rest of them had passed away by then. But lots of the houses and farms where my dad stayed or was hidden in are still there. And that's just amazing to go into these houses or farms and rooms where he was hidden and just be, you know, 75 or 70 or 75 years later, being in the same spot that my dad was in.
And I think it's worth repeating to the audience, but what would have happened to these people if they found your father in their farm?
Oh, they would have been either shot on the spot or interrogated to learn more, and then tortured and sent to concentration camps. So they were incredibly brave people. I've been to Belgium 6 times for various ceremonies and events and research. I've gone over there and filmed on 2 occasions. I've made a short documentary about it as well as the book. And to this day, the Belgian people are still so grateful and so thankful for the Americans coming to their rescue and liberating them from Nazi occupation and Nazi oppression. And they do a great job of educating the younger generations about the importance of remembering as well. They're wonderful people.
When did they celebrate the liberation of Belgium during World War II?
On September 2nd, the day that my dad hooked up with the U.S. Armies, that's the day that the U.S. Armies, you know, first entered Belgium in the little village of Sundron, and were the first, also on that day, September 2nd, was the day that 12 U.S. Soldiers, the first soldiers killed in the liberation of Belgium, died in a skirmish with some Nazi Waffen-SS panzers. There's a memorial to them as well, not too far from my dad's memorial. So it's on the September 2nd, in and around. They have ceremonies that last several days. I've gone over for the 50th, 60th, 70th, and 75th, which was last year. And they're wonderful events. All the townspeople come out. They erect these huge tents and have dances and band concerts. And the local beer chumage just flows, and everyone has a great time. And then they have more sober moments at these various memorials, where they have ceremonies and the dignitaries, all the local dignitaries, speech. The U.S. military, Belgian military, French military, the U.S. ambassadors of Belgium comes down. They're quite wonderful events.
Now, let me ask you, said there's a memorial to the Waffen-SS?
No.
Oh, okay.
No,
I thought that's what you said.
There was a memorial to the first 12 GIs that were killed fighting against the Waffen-SS.
Okay.
So there was a memorial to the first 12 men that were killed in the little village of Mansu in Brescia, and there's also a little museum there that has lots of artifacts and memorabilia of that event, and also involving the story of the Susan Roof.
Now, what did your father do after the war?
Oh, gosh. He did quite a few different things. Right after the war, he was an air traffic controller for a little while. And then my parents lived in Pasadena, California, where I was born. He started a restaurant, and he was the owned the restaurant. He was also the chef called Snyder's for 10 years. And then he got into various sales endeavors for quite a different things. And then finally, he retired from, he was a salesman and then actually acquired this little company called Acra Stamp Machine Company. And for people that are old enough, can remember redemption stamps, like the Blue Chip and S&H, these machines.
Right.
They dial like a telephone, and you'd put the stamps in there, and then, you know, the grocery stores or gas stations would, you know, dial the number of stamps that you would get to put in your redemption booklets and to get merchandise. He retired from that.
Now, let me ask, before we wrap up, is there one story that you think is unforgettable that we should share with the audience now?
I can't really say one story. I think the biggest thing is just, you know, the courage and bravery that my dad showed in getting back into the fight. But really, I think the main thing to get from the book is to remember the sacrifice of those young guys who fought and died for freedom. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died. Millions more were wounded. Millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of the U.S. and the world forever. And we, you know, World War II ended 75 years ago, and it's fading in people's memory, and we cannot let that happen. These guys, in my opinion, were the greatest generation, and we can never forget their sacrifice to preserve the freedoms that we enjoy today that so many people take for granted because they don't know what took place so long ago.
Well said. The name of the book, Shot Down, the author, Steve Snyder. It's the true story of his father, Pilot Howard Snyder, and the crew of the B-17, Susan Roof. Thank you for being on Connor's Corner.
Thank you.
I have children. How can I protect them if something happens?
Will my assets be lost if I go into a nursing home?
We have property.
How will it affect the ones still here?
Who will help us take care of Grandma?
These questions can be answered by calling 718-238-6500 for a free consultation from Connors & Sullivan Attorneys at Law, providing dedicated, caring, and highly responsive legal services. They're focused on issues that matter to you: protection of your family, preservation of your assets, and respect of your wishes with dignity.
That's all I want from a lawyer, making it easier for my children.
Call 718-238-6500. Get a free consultation. Connors & Sullivan's clients don't get lost in the cracks. They have dedicated attorneys who know their clients and the issues that matter most to them. Connors & Sullivan's estate planning, elder law, and probate attorneys work closely with every client. Don't leave behind problems for your family. Call 718-238-6500 and get a free consultation today.
Connors & Sullivan. Plan now for later.
Welcome back to Ask the Lawyer with me, Mike Connors, again accompanied by my wife, Beth.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, so, you know, let's not forget the true meaning of Memorial Day. Remember our fallen heroes. You know, usually, you know, we used to go with the Catholic War veterans at the Memorial Day Parade in Brooklyn, which is the oldest continuous parade in the United States. I know there's some people that argue that, but we're from Brooklyn, so we're going to take the Brooklyn
side.
We'll go with it, yeah. But obviously it's not happening this year.
And the Boy Scouts aren't putting flags on the graves.
Yeah, they're not? Okay.
No, they're not letting them. The VA, which is, that's a shame. I don't understand that, I'll be honest.
Yeah, because that's outside. And
it's outside. It's, you know, I think it's good to be outside in the sun. You know, But anyway, they made that decision. So that's a shame. So there's no decoration this year.
Okay. Now, you know, each week we start and end the show with David Kincaid singing On Hallowed Ground. And David Kincaid is a great Civil War historian. He's done a lot of songs. He sang a lot of songs about the Civil War era. On Hallowed Ground is not really that one of it. But it does fit, I think, the spirit of Memorial Day.
Absolutely.
You know, and the headquarters of this station, these stations are, 111 Broadway, which is right next to Trinity Church. And actually, the building is owned, my understanding is, by the Trinity Church building. So we kind of are on hallowed ground. And there's a lot of history there. You know, in the church cemetery, there's Alexander Hamilton, who I assume his grave has gotten a lot more visitors over the last few years than he had before that. And Robert Fulton, the inventor of the steamboat. And there are other people that were famous at their time that may not be household names today, but they were famous for his time. And On Hallowed Ground, I think, is a great song for our purposes because we deal a lot with history and we're trying to remember the sacrifices of our veterans over the years, and they do lie on hallowed ground. So thank you for listening to Ask the Lawyer. We'll be back next week.
God bless you all. Here on hallowed ground to sing this song away. We are gathered here on hallowed ground, voices raised, heads bowed down. We're gathered here on hallowed ground to sing this song away. We are gathered here on hallowed ground, voices raised, heads bowed down. We're gathered here on hallowed ground to sing this song away.
Hi, Kevin McCullough. Are you or your parents' assets protected from nursing home bills? Did you know these bills can exceed $15,000 a month? People work their entire lives to live comfortably in retirement, but when people become ill and need to go to a nursing home or receive home care, the bills can drain their assets, leaving many people bankrupt. The good news is that you can prevent that from happening if you plan in advance. Connors and Sullivan's lawyers can customize a plan that specifically protects your interests, including your home. Schedule a free comprehensive telephone consultation with Mike Connors to discuss your issues and concerns from the security of your home. Call today, 718-238-6500, 718-238-6500. Don't let nursing home bills take your life's savings and leave you and your loved ones bankrupt. Don't wait another minute. Mike Connors can take you through the process by telephone and start a plan designed for you today. That's 718-238-6500. 718-238-6500.
The preceding pre-recorded program paid for by Connors and Sullivan Attorneys at Law, PLLC.